Hello and welcome to season three of the Love Podcast with me, Pip.
And me, Sharon.
In this season, we'll be having conversations with mums and sons. We've called it Mums and Sons.
Yes, we have. We've called it Mums and Sons. So in the first half of the season, there'll be conversations with me and I'll be talking to different mums who are at different stages of the motherhood journey. They'll be sharing what their expectations were going into motherhood and what's happened ever since they became mothers. And also they'll be sharing with us some helpful advice, which I have really been blessed by.
Wonderful. Enjoy the episodes.
Louise. So, Louise, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. So, my name is Louise, Louise Lamidi or Louise Walker Nathenda, depending on what you want to call me. I've got two daughters, both teenagers. I've got a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old. I work in medical research, and I've been doing this for a lot of years. And it's sort of so I kind of juggle the whole sort of motherhood thing and work. I've actually never worked part time. It's been quite the journey, but yeah, that's essentially me. I live in North London with my husband and my two daughters.
Well, thank you so much, Louise, for volunteering to share your experiences of motherhood. So you have two teenage girls, and to some people that can sound quite scary.
It is quite scary.
So talk us through, like, what were your expectations going into motherhood, and particularly, you know, coming into the teenage years? Because some people from, like, I've got two children, one's six and one's three. And, you know, some people from now are kind of dreading those teenage years. So kind of talk us through what your expectations were and what you're experiencing now.
Sure. So I come from quite a big family. I'm one of seven children. I'm number two of seven. Wow. So there is quite a big age gap between myself and number four, five, six, seven. I think I was probably about 10 when I had those younger siblings. So I thought I sort of used to help, you know, changing nappies. I think I'm probably about 14, 15 years older than my youngest brother. So at that time I could change nappies. I could make a bottle. I could wash the bottles and, do a spot of babysitting and all of that sort of stuff. So going into motherhood, I thought it was going to be a walk in the park. I thought, well, I already know how to change nappies. I already know how to kind of look after kids. And we were very excited when my mom was having our younger siblings, because my mom was quite a reader. So she had this book, which is called Dr. Spock, which was the manual that everybody used in the 70s and 80s when they had children. And I read it at the age of nine from cover to cover. And wow, we used to read it all the time. You know, we'd read it and we'd follow the milestones and that sort of thing. So I thought motherhood was going to be a walk in the park. It was because I sort of already knew what to do. However, nothing prepares you for the sleepless nights. Like, that was the bit of motherhood that I had no idea happened, because obviously the babies never slept with us. Yeah. So that in itself was a huge shock to the system. When we were sort of able to sort of get over that, then it sort of became easier again. Yeah. And I remember my sister-in-law saying to me once that I think I talked about my daughter wanting to sleep in my bed, and she said, oh, Louise, you want to enjoy it while you can, because when they become teenagers, they're not going to want to sleep in your bed unless it's a toss-up between your bed and the bathtub, you know. Literally, that actually happened. And she's like, look, you enjoy it while it lasts, you know, it's not going to be forever. Yeah. Becoming a mom of teenagers, it kind of creeps up on you, like, you know, one day they're happy to hold your hand, and the next day you're crossing the street and you're looking for their hand where it should be. They're folding it because they're like, I'm not going to hold your hand. And that's a shock.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens from when they're like 9 or 10, you know, just as they're coming to year six. And then it's it's downhill. No, I'm just joking. It becomes progressively more different from what from the childhood year. They want to be independent. They want to do things on their own, but then they can't because they're not like the teenage brain is not fully functional. It's not fully formed.
Yeah.
So the decision making skills are not quite there. But they want to make all the decisions by themselves, and then there's the mood swings, and I have to wake up every morning and wonder which child has gotten out of bed. Is it the angry child or is it the happy child? You know, so it's kind of balancing that, but it's also sort of as a parent finding the balance so that even if they're in a bad mood, you don't sort of add to it or you know, sort of worse. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So, how would you say that your own upbringing has fed into the way you parent your children?
I think everything. My parents got divorced when I was quite young. My parents got divorced when I was about 4, and then my mom remarried again, hence the other siblings. Mm-hmm. But both of my parents kind of agreed on the same thing, which was they wanted their kids to be very independent.
Mm-hmm.
So they raised independent children, and I feel that sometimes sometimes I might sort of expect, and I think I probably sort of expect too much of my children sometimes. Like I just expect them to be able to do XYZ, and of course they can't do XYZ because they're 14 or they're 13 or they're not old enough to do it. But then I think, oh, but when I was your age, I did it. But I did it out of necessity, and probably the environment that I grew up in as well.
But
a lot of times I've had to step back, and I think also the way my husband was brought up was quite different. Whereas I was brought up to be very, very independent.
Mm.
He wasn't brought up to be that independent.
Mm.
So sometimes I always feel, oh, catch up. You're slacking. Because I expect that my kids should be independent and he should be reinforcing, you know, that.
Yeah.
And it's perhaps not the right way, you know, all the time.
So how do you kind of develop a, you know, like a cohesive approach, like where you've come from very different backgrounds? Like, did you, going into parenting, did you both discuss this is the type of parents we want to be, this is the upbringing we want our kids to have?
Well, to be honest with you, we've been married for 19 years, but we didn't actually really discuss exactly sort of parents we were going to be. I think I erroneously thought that because we both came from African backgrounds, we would have the same sort of experience or the same, at least the same sort of narrative. Mm. And it wasn't necessarily that. We didn't. I mean, I came from a family where I wasn't smacked at all.
Wow.
Some of the punishments I got, I look back and I was like, oh gosh, that was so ridiculous. Like my mom would say, she'd say, right, because when my mom would come back from work, we'd all go into her bedroom, we'd sit on her bed, we'd talk to her about our day and all of that. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of our bonding time every single day. But like if you did something really bad, she'd say, right, this evening you're not allowed to come into my room. You're going to wash the dishes or something. And then you'd hear everybody in her room laughing and having fun. And you'd be like the stepsister or something in the kitchen, like the Cinderella. But that was our currency, you know. That was our, and you knew that it was a big deal that you wanted to be with the family, you know, talking, and you know, after dinner we'd all sort of migrate to her room and then we'd just kind of talk and then everybody would go to bed. It would probably for like, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, but it was a big deal not to be part of that conversation. Yeah. Yeah, but I look back now and I think, well, you know, why was I so upset not being allowed to go into my mom's room? But I understand at the time it was important. So I came from that sort of background. He came from a background where they were punished. They were smacked from time to time. I mean, it wasn't a continuous thing, but they were smacked from time to time. But I what we both decided was that we weren't going to smack our kids, and that was one thing that we had both decided, that we wouldn't smack them. But other than that, we kind of didn't really decide on what sort of parents we wanted to be, and we kind of winged it, if you like. We just kind of you know, we'd get to a bridge and we'd say, okay, we're gonna do this or do that, and then we sort of cross it and sort of navigate it as we went along.
Yeah. So both coming from African backgrounds, like, do you feel that you've steered your children like towards being really academic, or have you allowed them to kind of express their creativity?
I would say both. Probably more on the academic side. Like, both of my parents were academics. My father was a professor. So I am a very academic person normally anyway. Well, my upbringing, I guess. And my mother was very academic as well. A lot of my punishments, apart from being banned from my mom's room, would be, you know, if I was rude to my mom, I'd have to write an essay about rudeness. You know, it was just
wow.
That sort of,
yeah.
Same with my dad as well. Like, my dad would make you do it. My mom would read it and she would read the content and speak to you about the content. My father would, first of all, for the first 2 weeks, he would be correcting your grammar, your syntax, all of that. And then get you to write it several times correctly. You know, your spellings, you know, have you stopped with all American spellings, or are there some American spellings and British spellings? Pick one, you know, that sort of thing. My father was a professor, you know, and then after that, then he talked about the content, you know, and, you know, to talk to you about the content. But that was the kind of family that I came from. I mean, I haven't sort of gotten my children to do that yet.
that must have been such a deterrent. Like, I would have been naughty once and never again.
And never be naughty again, absolutely. But what I have found out that I have done in the past has been, we'd go on holiday and we'd come back from holiday and I'd say, you know what, write an essay about your holiday, you know, you know, holiday, you know, what you liked, what you didn't like, what you would like to see next time, you know, that sort of a thing. And, you know, when my younger one was when she was about 4 or 5 and obviously couldn't really write, you know, long sentences, I'd say, no problem, just write, you know, 1 or 2 sentences, but use a lot of wow words, you know, like really nice adjectives and that sort of a thing. And,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, I think she's probably the more academic of both of my kids.
Yeah.
My older child is very, very artistic. And I do encourage that. I'm probably a bit more academic than, you know, than not. Mm. But that's probably because I have no artistic flair whatsoever. Like, nothing.
I don't believe that.
Honestly speaking, I haven't. I was the child who found it really hard to colour in, you know, within the lines. I have no idea why, but yeah.
But you're artistic in your speech, because you can tell a very good story, especially on Facebook.
Well, I can, because I have a family where I had to write essays, where I had to express myself, you know, in words and that sort of thing. That's probably why.
Yeah. Well, we're benefiting from it.
Thank you very much.
So going into kind of more of the challenges of motherhood, what would you say has been your kind of biggest challenge or darkest moment of motherhood, if you wouldn't mind sharing it with us?
Absolutely. So there's two that stand out. One of them was when my older daughter had to have surgery, and it was quite a sort of invasive surgery. She had to have a surgery on her spine, and it was during the COVID time. It had been sort of put off at the beginning of COVID, but her situation was getting worse, and it had to be done. So I was allowed to stay with her in hospital. Mm. The stay in hospital was fine. We were basically locked up in the hospital. We couldn't really go anywhere. I couldn't go anywhere. I was being fed so that I wouldn't have to go out and buy food and bring COVID back. Well, you know, that sort of a thing. So that was fine. But when we got home, that was when the real challenge started, because I had to sort of sleep in her room. She was quite immobile. You know, I had to sort of put a mattress on the floor in her room and sleep there so that I could give her medication in the middle of the night, because it was, you know, there was kind of like a timetable. And then she couldn't turn on her bed either, so I had to sort of turn her so that she wouldn't have bed sores. And it was quite a dark moment for me. And like I said, this sort of happened during the COVID period, so nobody could visit. We could sort of come and help. But we kind of got through it as a family, I'd say. I mean, we had a lot of help from a lot of our friends at church and our sort of small group, like a home fellowship. And, you know, they sort of would cook meals and leave it by the door. So I didn't have to cook all the time. And my kids started to love Ghanaian food because one of the families that used to cook, you know, they were Ghanaian. So they used to make lovely, lovely Ghanaian food. And Ghanaian jollof as well. Because we're Nigerian, right? But anyway, it was fantastic. It was, you know, we needed a lot of pillows, and they were like, no, don't buy pillows. We have loads of pillows and blankets and that sort of a thing. And so that really helped. That helped lift it. And I would sort of wake up in the morning, and I was working from home as well, if you think about it, during the pandemic. And I was pilot, so I would wake up, give my child a bath. And at this time, she would have been about 15, 16. So she wasn't a little child. She was, you know, an who really liked her privacy, but obviously couldn't have privacy because I had to give her a wash or, you know, that sort of thing. And I had to help her go to the loo and all of that. But that was quite a trying time for me. And her as well. I had to learn patience because there were times when I would kind of snap. And I wasn't snapping because I was angry at her inability to do things, but just because I was tired. I was physically tired. And then I would have to sort of pull back and say, oh, you know, I'm the only one who can give her a bath. Her dad can't, you know, but he would help with. So I would kind of let him do the other things. And then the things that I had to do that, then I would do those things. But that was a really, really dark moment for us. The second bit was I lost my mom during the pandemic as well. So after my daughter's operation, my mom passed. So my daughter's operation was in the October, October, and my mom died the following year in March, and that was a really dark time for us because we didn't see it coming. It just sort of happened during the pandemic, and it sort of happened, and I was. At the time, my mom lived in Nigeria, and I was on autopilot. Like, me and my siblings would have these meetings and, you know, to plan the funeral. And I was the only one who was able to go from here. My older sister lives in Australia, and Australia was in the total lockdown, so she couldn't go. My younger brother was in lives in America, and he caught COVID just before. So he wasn't going to be traveling anywhere. So it was just me and my other siblings who lived in Nigeria who were able to go. But I felt incredibly blessed that I was able to go. For me, I think losing my mom was a real blow. Like I said, I didn't see it coming. You know, I just kind of wasn't able to function. And I knew very early on that I would need bereavement counselling. And I did seek it. But obviously, they don't offer it to you until like 6 months after.
Right.
And so, after I felt that I was coping, but then during the time I know that my kids I wasn't the same person that I had been before my mom passed away. And I see that they were trying to get me out of this sort of dark mood, depression, if you like. I was still doing working and you know delivering at work and, you know, doing really well at work, but work was my escapism. And my older daughter would come and say, oh, mom, remember you wanted to plant things in the garden. Why don't we do this? And, you know, why don't we do that? And I could see what she was trying to do. I could see that she was trying to get a snap out of it. But I always said to myself that I didn't want my kids to feel responsible for my mental health.
Yeah.
It was a really dark time. And I would just kind of, you know, log on to work. And then I would log off, and I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping properly. And then I would, you know, doing a lot of things through escapism. I would watch rubbish videos on YouTube, rubbish Nollywood videos on YouTube, and I would watch them in double time because I'd watch them in double time so that I didn't even it was a brainless activity, but out of grieving, if you like. So for me, that was a pretty dark moment as well.
So how did you cope with it? Like, what were the kind of like practical things that you did? And how, because I mean, in those moments, I don't know how people can deal with the grief and still be a mother. So like, how did you, is there anything like that you kind of practically did or anything that like helped you in that time to cope with everything?
Yes. So like I said, there was a lot of escapism, and I think psychologists would tell you that it's not a bad thing to, you know, but okay. I think it's not good to sort of stay there forever and ever.
Yeah.
So escapism, and you know, it is fine. But what the practical things that I had to do, I was sort of praying more, mm-hmm. and sometimes praying more when I could, and sometimes I would say, I really can't pray today. I guess the prayers that I prayed yesterday or 3 weeks ago are gonna have to sustain me because it's just not working.
Yeah.
But it was some of that. But I think also it was making a conscious decision to say, right, tonight we're gonna have a family dinner. And normally when we sit at the table to have a family dinner, it's a gadget-free dinner. So everybody puts away their gadgets, and that's pretty hard for teenagers to do.
Yeah.
But that's basically what our family dinners are like. We put away our gadgets and we talk.
Mm.
It didn't really have to be about anything, you know, serious, but the fact that we were talking, and we were doing, you know, other things. Sometimes I'd sort of go out with the girls and we'd go to Wood Green, shopping center there, and it would be something very, very mundane, like, right, we need a pair of jeans. Let's go look for a pair of jeans at Wood Green. Mm. And then we would, and it wasn't necessarily something that we had to do because you could buy everything online. But once the shops opened, like I said, my mom passed away during lockdown. And so A, we couldn't really go anywhere and nobody was coming to the house and all of that. But after we buried her, it sort of eased off a little bit. Mm. So we'd sort of go places together, and I kind of tried to do more things, especially with the girls, because I didn't want them to feel as though they were losing their mom. And in a lot of ways, I think that they did. And I always think that they probably haven't gotten the same mom that they got before my mom passed away. But
yeah,
and I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing or good thing. It's just a thing. But
yeah,
we need to make the best out of that situation. We need to make the best out of the mom that I am.
Mm.
It was making a conscious effort to do things with them.
Yeah.
Not mundane it was, but we were just doing things together.
Yeah. So how would you say that your kind of journey as a mother and the things that you've experienced whilst being a mother have like shaped your relationship with God?
I think for me, I've kind of learned to pray more. For the girls as well. Obviously, when I was footloose, fancy free, and it was just me, most of my prayers would have been about me or about other people loosely. But it's sort of made me very, very intentional about praying for them and about praying for the sort of friends that they have and the sort of friendships that they have, and praying that they would have, like, you know, really wholesome friendships. And in a lot of ways, I do see that, you know, those prayers come to pass. Mm. I do happening. I do kind of look back and think, oh my goodness, my daughter's got some really good friends. And girls, and maybe I say this because I grew up in a house where we're predominantly female, and also I had I've got girls as well, but they have some really good wholesome friendships. I remember when my daughter came out of hospital, and she wasn't allowed, I didn't allow her to eat any junk food at all, because I wanted her to eat, you know, wholesome meals, lots of veg, lots of fruit to promote healing and, you know, her immunity. Yeah. And very immunocompromised when she came out of hospital, but when she was given the go ahead to eat whatever, her friends came over and they made her a hamper. It was really nice, but it was full of junk food. They had instant noodles, Haribos, donuts, and she ate like 12 donuts at a sitting and was sick because she needed 12 donuts. But it was that sort of thing. I just sort of thought, well, that's quite thoughtful of them, because they know that these are the sort of things that she likes and she was missing. I mean, even though it wasn't kind of my choice of hamper, but yeah, but they, those are the sort of really wholesome friendships that you pray for your kids to have.
Yeah.
And it's really pray more as a mother, pray more, you know, very, very, very intently and very intensely as well. Praying for another with that sort of intensity as well. I sort of learned to do that being a mum.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely finding that the further in the journey I get, the more I'm just like, God, I just don't know what to do. Like, help me.
Yeah, I get to that point every single time, especially now that they're teenagers. I'm like, God, I really don't know how I have no idea what I'm doing here. You know, I don't even think I'm winging it successfully. You know, you're gonna have to step in and save the day because, you know, and so it's kind of helped me to look to God more as well.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I just kind of wouldn't really know what to do. I'd be lost.
Yeah, 100%. And so what would you say has been like the biggest lesson you've learned in motherhood that you could share? You know, like you said before, some things like you just can't be prepared for. So you learn it on the job, but actually perhaps if someone had told you before you became a mother, it would have been really helpful to know.
Yeah. I think for me it's been positive. Well, patience is one, but I think positive words, positive affirmation has been
Okay.
a really big one. And we always know that, you know, you should be positive, you should speak to people positively and all of that. And it's everybody knows that and everybody kind of tries to practice it. But when you have teenagers, it is so much harder. It is that much harder because they know everything, obviously, and you're trying them. There's a pit there, you don't want to walk there. And they're being really stubborn, and I know what I'm doing, and you know they're going to walk into that pit and fall in there. But as a parent, sometimes you have to sort of take a step back, watch them fall into it, and pull them out, and try not to say I told you so. I've had situations where my teenagers have sort of been in moods, had like really bad mood swings, and would say they and would probably not be speaking to me for like a few days, 3 days, 4 days, and I've had to sort of pull them out of it. And the way that you pull them out of it effectively is by being positive, because they're already defensive. They feel like you're going to tell them off, or you're going to say you, they feel like you're going to say something negative, or something that they perceive as negative, you know, tell them off or tell them they're not good enough. And teenagers always feel like their parents feel they're not good enough. So you say to them, you're a freaking rock star, you know, you are. And which is I say this quite often, and I say things like, well, the only thing that makes me sad is the fact that you don't realize how much of a rock star that you are, you know. It's not that I don't. It's not. I think you're good enough, and I think you're even better than I would could ever imagine. What bad is the fact that you don't even realize it, you know? And I've had to sort of tell my daughter the story of the Tower of Babel, where God, what the Bible says that God looked down and said, you know, man is incredibly powerful. Like now, there's nothing that they set their mind to do that they won't do, and I've said that it just goes to show, really, there's nothing that you set your mind to do that you won't do, or that you can't do. And you know, it's telling her that I acknowledge that this is what can happen, and I know that it can happen. So, you know, kind of come to my side and then be positive, you know, and be positive about yourself. It is quite hard. So you've got a daughter and a son, haven't you? I don't know if parents boys is any easier. Maybe they don't have to. Maybe
I
I don't
just
know.
think parenting's hard. So.
But parenting is hard. Nothing would ever prepare you for it. And I think it's you forget that at some stage they're going to want to do things by themselves, and they're going to want to be independent. And they're independent, and they don't necessarily have the emotional capacity to be as independent as they want to be. But they, you know, they're kind of kicking and fighting. I want to do this by myself. I want to make all my decisions. But one thing that I also learned is, as a mother, is always to trust your instinct. There's sometimes my kids have asked me if they could go places or do stuff, and I just sort of get a witness or a feeling that they shouldn't do it. And I've said no, and I have no qualms in saying no at all. I'm the boring parent. I'm the parent who says no, and I have no. My husband, on the other hand, doesn't, and he says, "Well, the girls are never angry with me." I'm like, "Yeah, that's because you're a prolific sitter on the fence. You can't, if you sit on the fence, they're never going to be angry. I'm the one who has to do the hard work. I'm the one who has to say no." But I have no. I make no bones about saying no, and most times I say no, and I wouldn't really be able to explain why I'm saying no. It's just a feeling, and to them, it's just a feeling. Does not make any sense, and it makes them angrier. But 10 times out of 10, when I've said no, we found out later on that it was the right decision.
Yeah.
So I put my finger on it. It was kind of like when they lie. Well, one of them kind of tells fibs. The other one just doesn't. And I always say to her, like, I don't know what the full story is, but see, your version is not the truth. You know, and I can't say what it is, but I know that her version is not the truth.
Yeah.
And then obviously after that, but it's that sort of thing with, you know, parenting decisions when they're teenagers and they want to go to a party here or they want to, you know, do this or do that. 10 times out of 10, when I've said no, or when I felt uneasy about it, it become obvious much later that it was the right decision to say no.
Wow. That is so powerful. Like, I'm like taking mental notes in my head. that is so powerful. So in terms of like any other kind of like advice or anything that you'd like to say before we wrap things up that could be helpful to someone starting or in the motherhood journey?
I think for me, you can't sort of reiterate it enough. Positive words of affirmation. I mean, you know, I'm the touchy-feely parent. I'm the parent who would say I love you and that sort of a thing. But your kids need to know that you're a soft landing, and wherever they go, they can always come back home, even if they've messed up. And their first thought shouldn't be, "Oh, I've messed up. I need to run away from mom." Their thought should be, "I've messed up. I need to go tell mom. I need my mom to help me." Like I said, even though I'm the strict parent, if my kids got into trouble, I'm the parent that they would call. And growing up, that was the same with us, with my mom. We always knew that we could always come back. And you know, it was the unconditional love. We always knew that, always. Very important. Sometimes it feels hard when they're being really headstrong and not listening. But, you know, above all of it, they should always, you know, you should always sort of make them aware that you're always there, and you are the soft landing, you are the haven, if you like.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, that was so powerful. Thank you so much, Louise. I really appreciate just hearing your experiences and you sharing that wisdom with me.